You're listening to local and regional news on KMUN 91.9 FM. I'm Skylar Butenchen.
And I'm Katie Frankowitz. Three candidates are vying for three open seats on the Clatsop County Board of Commissioners. All three candidates are currently running unchallenged, but filing doesn't close until March 10th. Current commissioners Pamela Webb and Leanne Thompson have already told KMUN they do not intend to run for re-election. However, Board Chair Mark Quila is trying for a third term, running again for his District 1 seat that represents primarily the Warrenton and Hammond areas, people and places he previously represented as mayor of Warrenton. He was first elected to the County Board of Commissioners in 2018 and won re-election in 2022. Quila works as the executive director for the Columbia Memorial Hospital Foundation and has been leading efforts to fundraise for CMH's massive expansion project in Astoria. For Quila and other commission candidates, economic development is front of mind. In December, Oregon Governor Tina Kotek's office published a roadmap to prosperity that, among other things, discusses the need to reduce barriers to investment and growth. For Quila, that means tangible change around permitting on the rural Oregon coast. He has in mind key properties in Clatsop County, such as Warrenton's North Coast Business Park, home to Costco and Walmart, among other businesses, and where local leaders see plenty more room for development.
We say, hey, okay, if the state is really interested in this, we don't want it to just be for a certain part of the state. We want it to be rural areas too. And rural counties deserve that.
It is something he says he's pushing for now and would continue to push for if reelected. Quila feels the role of county commissioner has evolved during his time on the board. He says it is clear the county does have influence at the state and federal level, and that commissioners have worked to build relationships with state and federal leaders, as well as local businesses and nonprofits.
I think that we are primed now to be able to, you know, lean on those as we go to the state. And, you know, funding is certainly at a premium for everyone. But I think we've positioned ourselves in a really good way. So I want to continue to see that. And I want to continue to just get everyone together, work on the strategic plan update at the beginning when new commissioners come in. We'll all sit down, kind of spend some time together, find out what's important to everybody, but then also boil it down to here's the structure and the framework that we're going to operate under, and everything we do is going to kind of come back to this.
He says the Board of Commissioners has an opportunity to be a facilitator for the cities and community groups across the county. Mike Brocious agrees. He says the county should be a conduit, bringing everything together. Brocious, a retired Costco executive, is running for Webb's District 3 seat, which is centered on Astoria. With his years at Costco and his community involvement in Oregon, he comes with a lot of connections and has been building more in Clatsop County since he moved here full-time roughly 4 years ago. Brocious sees a need to push for a more solid vision of what the county wants to be in the next 20 or even 30 years.
Economic diversity is vital. So they've got a number of different things going on. They've got the industrial park potential out at Costco, by near Costco, that they're looking at. So, you know, it's going to be essential that whatever we do there, because that whatever's done there is done forever. You know, so we've got to make sure that we've got the right developer and we've got the right mix of what's going to go into that space, because once it's there, it's there. And I have that business expertise and to really challenge and look at what are we doing there and what's the overall plan. I think that's what's traditionally missing in government in general is they have no North Star. They don't know where they want to be in 20 or 30 years because all they're trying to figure out is what's the next 6 months or 2 years or the election cycle going to be. I really want to help push that, hey, what do we want to be as a county in 20 or 30 years from now?
Last year, Brocious was an applicant for the Ward 4 seat on the Astoria City Council after then-Councillor Vance Lump moved out of the area. Brocious was a top contender for that seat, but was passed over in favor of current Ward 4 City Councilor Josh Conklin. In the race for county commissioner, Brocious argues that he is a candidate to help the county understand how to diversify its economy, advocate for funding, and identify additional funding streams. He wants to help facilitate and build what he calls living wage careers, and he sees particular opportunities in the maritime industry and with light manufacturing. In Astoria, Brocious is involved with a number of community boards, including at Clatsop Community College, CMH, and the Liberty Theater. Meanwhile, in the District 5 race, Rand Dufka, a contractor and longtime Arch Cape resident, says he was talked into running by current Commissioner Leanne Thompson. Dufka feels Thompson has done a lot for South County. He would like to see her work and initiatives continue. Dufka says South County faces a number of challenges.
I see a lack of law enforcement down here in regards to the county. Our law enforcement is tied to the timber industry. And over the years, the conservation side of that has really put a cut into the revenue that our county law enforcement depended on in the past. And every year it gets less and less. So it's becoming an incredible challenge for the county to be able to provide the services that residents require.
Economic development is also a concern in a county that historically depended on fishing and timber and has seen both industries shift. Dufka owns Arch Cape Construction, and all of his work is in Clatsop County. He feels this gives him some insight into what it means for small businesses to operate in the county. He also feels businesses need to take an active role in developing housing for employees. Dufka is also interested in the county helping facilitate more gun safety education at the local school level. A gun owner and hunter himself, Dufka worries that emphasis on proper gun safety, how to handle firearms and respect what firearms can do, has dwindled, even as access to guns and gun ownership has followed an upward trend nationally. Overall, Dufka says his top priority is to make sure South County continues to have representation.
I just want to be a conduit for the constituents of the South County. That's basically why I'm doing this. I just think being a father and a business owner and being successful at it, I have a pretty good talent in being able to manage issues and solving problems. I think I can be a good addition to the commission.
Ballots will begin to go out for the May 19th primary in late April. I'm Katie Frankowitz, reporting for KMUN.
This is KMUN News. I'm Skylar Butenchen. Emergency work on the Astoria-Megler Bridge on-ramp begins tomorrow night, February 19th. The bridge will be fully closed starting at 9 p.m. tomorrow. The full closure lasts until 6 a.m. Friday morning. The Oregon Department of Transportation says it will be removing the old toll booth structure after inspection damage was found. For all updates on the Astoria-Megler Bridge closure, go online at tripcheck.com. A recall election is currently underway involving Seaside City Councilor Seamus McVeigh. Elected to the council in 2024, McVeigh represents Seaside's Ward 3. His term is set to expire at the end of 2028. Andy Toombs filed the initial recall petition last October with the City of Seaside. Toombs is alleging that McVeigh was elected to his council seat under what could be considered false pretenses. She cites that he had not disclosed a name change or that he had served time for several crimes committed under his prior name. McVeigh maintains that he had been honest about his past, opening up publicly at council meetings and in the press. He says his past has helped him to be more understanding of others and allowed him to see what change is possible. Concerning his name change, McVeigh has recently gone public with the story, saying that he did it because of his estrangement from his father. Toombs says it's irrelevant that McVeigh was public about his past before being elected, She claims that most of the voters in Ward 3 had not known about it when they voted, and if they had known then, they may not have voted the same way. McVeigh says he will continue to attend Seaside City Council meetings throughout the recall election process. Ballots for the recall election will be mailed out to all registered voters in Seaside's Ward 3 next Wednesday, February 25th. Ballots must be delivered to an official drop site or the Clatsop County Clerk's Office no later than 8 p.m. March 17th. And ballots that are mailed must be postmarked by March 17th. This story comes to us through a news partnership with The Astorian. A Virginia-based lobby group is trying to change Idaho state funding for the state's longest-running medical education program. They want to make it contingent on adopting policies that are against diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. But educators who run the program say they already follow state law. NWPB's Rachel Sun reports.
Idaho has the lowest number of physicians per capita in the country. For decades, one program has helped train students to practice in the state, the University of Washington's WAMI Medical Education Program. WAMI stands for Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Montana, and Idaho, and focuses on bringing doctors to rural western states. Since 1972, hundreds of doctors have graduated from WAMI's Idaho program, more than half of whom stayed to practice in the state. One of those doctors is Robert McFarland. He practiced medicine for about 35 years in Coeur d'Alene.
The goal is to train students who will return to Idaho and who will serve where there is need in Idaho. And it's been very successful at that.
A Virginia-based lobby group, Do No Harm, is seeking to make the program state funding contingent on adopting anti-DEI policies. That stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion.
I don't know how an organization based in Virginia is qualified to talk about Idaho values, but I've lived my whole life here. I was born in Idaho, and one of the chief values that I recognize is that we look out for our neighbors, and we do try to help people who are down on their luck, and it would be counter to Idaho values and certainly not the right thing if we didn't do that.
Dr. Frank Baca is the assistant clinical dean for the Idaho WAMI program. He says there's nothing in the program, from classes to admission selections, that could be considered DEI based on what the group is lobbying against.
You know, some of their whereases in this resolution are just blatantly erroneous.
Idaho WAMI students spend their first 2 years training in-state before continuing their education in Washington State. Baca says then they have the option to take elective courses on subjects like abortion and gender-affirming care. But those classes are not required, they're not taught in Idaho, and they aren't paid for by state funds.
We don't have any electives here in Idaho that would train or require our students to do anything that would violate Idaho law.
Abortion is illegal in Idaho, and gender-affirming care is illegal in the state for minors. McFarland, who served on Idaho's WAMI admissions committee, says he's not sure how the program could be more compliant with Idaho laws. But he says he worries if the state adopts the resolution, it could have a chilling effect on accepting well-qualified applicants. He says if a student happens to be part of a minority group or have interest in caring for underserved populations, admissions committees shouldn't have to worry that their selection would be perceived as DEI.
So if we admit a student who states that she wants to return to Idaho and include in her practice that group of people, that doesn't mean that we're biased toward the minority group.
So far, no legislators have attached their names to the resolution. A lawmaker would have to get involved to have the legislature formally consider it. In Moscow, Idaho, I'm Rachel Sun.
Yesterday was the first day of the Lunar New Year. It's the biggest holiday for lots of people in East and Southeast Asia. More residents in the inland Northwest are starting to celebrate it too. Spokane Public Radio's Eliza Billingham reports from Spokane's largest gathering.
Ah! The last time I was in this exhibit room, I was picking up my race packet for Bloomsday. Today, the hall feels just as crowded, but with sumo wrestlers, Chinese lion dancers, and hyper-creative vendors selling hand-painted masks and nail art. Two guys walking around in inflatable pony costumes seem out of place until I realize, oh yeah, it's the year of the horse. This is Lunar New Year in Spokane. It's the fifth year Spokane's United We Stand has put on a Saturday celebration for the entire city. The event quickly outgrew the pavilion and other smaller venues, so now it's at the top of Spokane's convention center. Vina Cathcart, one of the main organizers, says the idea came in the middle of the pandemic.
There was a lot of Asian hate rhetoric going around, and we honestly felt like we didn't have a space at that time. And so in the midst of that, we wanted to create something that brought everyone together. No matter if you're Asian, Black, White, Native American, Pacific Islander, Hawaiian, we wanted a space that everyone can celebrate.
Lunar New Year follows the lunisolar calendar and always falls sometime between the end of January and the beginning of February. In Asia, it's a multi-day event.
So for Vietnamese culture, I'm Vietnamese, my family celebrates for 3 days. For Chinese culture, it's 15 days.
She says people often go back to their hometowns in the countryside for lots of food and games. The focus is on family reunion, honoring ancestors, and communal celebration.
We eat, we drink, we party, let's do it for the entire Spokane, right?
This isn't the first time the city has marked this major holiday.
Spokane actually celebrated the Lunar New Year back in the 1800s. So Chinese and Japanese workers that immigrated here, that worked on the railroad here, and we had a great, vibrant kind of international district. So there's Trent Alley, there was the Chinese railroad workers, there was this whole international district that celebrated Lunar New Year.
This celebration also gives local performers a chance to showcase their unique talents. Jiu-jitsu athletes give demonstrations, then Japanese taiko drummers perform highly coordinated routines. Dancers in traditional Chinese dress and makeup mingle in the crowd, and students dressed as money gods and princesses offer to take photos. There's even a live petting zoo with a miniature Jerusalem donkey and a small pony. They are a little less energetic than the horse of the Chinese zodiac, which is known for independence, confidence, and ambition. Each Lunar New Year is associated with one of those 12 zodiac animals and one of five elements. That means 2026 isn't just the year of the horse, but also the year of fire. That suggests the year will be especially fast-paced, intense, and full of opportunity. In that same vein, Cathcart is hoping Spokane's Lunar New Year celebration will keep growing as rapidly as it has so far.
You know how we have Hoop Fest weekend, we have Bloomsday weekend. I want to see us grow into something like that where we can fill multiple days, have, you know, enough appetite for a parade or a block party.
She admits that a Northwest winter makes an outside festival in Spokane a little more difficult than in Southeast Asia. In the fun of it all, I completely forget to pick up a red envelope, a traditional gift filled with money to promote good luck and prosperity. I'm distracted by the spam musubi, a traditional Hawaiian snack, in one corner, and a basketball competition in the other.
It's good chaos. Like, you see, you know, thousands of people, and you're like, holy crap, there's thousands of people here. But as soon as you walk through those doors, you're like family, which is what the New Year sentiment is. It's like, it's a reunion for our friends and our family, and truly everyone here is. As soon as you walk through the doors, you're our friends and our family.
I'm Eliza Billingham, reporting.
The California Coastal Commission will oversee the transfer of a property in Humboldt County to local tribes. Jefferson Public Radio's Justin Higginbottom reports.
Developer Travis Schneider violated multiple permit requirements constructing his large home near Humboldt Bay. The 21,000-square-foot house was over twice the approved size. The section encroached into a protected wetland buffer area, and an unauthorized road removed native vegetation. Wiat tribes say the construction damaged culturally sensitive land. Now, after years of negotiation, Snyder will transfer the property to those tribes. Vice Chair Carol Hart celebrated the decision.
It's an enormous violation, and to have a land back provision. You want to talk about environmental justice. There is no more just result than the one here.
Snyder will also pay $400,000 in fines, demolish the partially built home, and restore the land. Justin Higginbottom, JPR News.
News on KMUN is brought to you by our news partners and by the KMUN News team. That's all from us today. Thanks for listening to KMUN.